All right, once again, this is Baptist Basics University. The course is Baptist History. This is lesson number 8. We're going to deal with Baptist expansion and division, focusing on the 18th through 20th centuries, getting into some recent stuff here. So let's just jump right in there. Well, as forms of religious freedom were gaining ground in Europe, Baptists began to flourish, as I said in the previous lesson. Places like Holland, where the freedom was granted, Baptists flourished. In England, when Baptists gained some tolerance and some freedoms, Baptists would flourish. So Baptist teaching was beginning to literally spread across the globe at this time. Now, as also during this time that the prefix Anna, A-N-A, began disappearing from Anabaptist and becomes a lot more common to see Baptist. Baptists were very happy for this because they got tired of being called Anabaptists, and we covered that a little bit before. However, to be perfectly fair and balanced in this, even though Baptists were making a lot of ground, there's a lot of division that takes place and a lot of strife and a lot of controversy, and we're going to cover some of that as we go through here. Now, is during this time that a new awareness of the Baptist identity begins to grow. People are finally appreciating who they were, what they were, and their heritage. Much progress was being made in groups unifying and sitting down and really determining and defining true Baptist doctrine. Now, some groups, such as the Mennonites, would split from the mainstream Baptist and kind of formed their own denomination. But Baptists at this time were getting together. They were defining their faith and really beginning to come together as a denomination. At this time, associations and conventions become very popular. At first, what these were a lot of independent congregations, small, usually, you know, country, rural congregations would kind of pull their forces to further their work. What they would do is they would get together and be able to support different, like, evangelists or ministries and such. They also did that to get a little bit more political power in some cases. Now, these in the early days rarely had any authority because Baptists believed the sovereignty of the local church. These were merely guys got together and they decided to do something. They pledged to finance it, and that's just the way it worked. In fact, there are records of times where guys would get together. In fact, we'll talk a little bit here in a little bit about Andrew Fuller. Andrew Fuller was key in gaining finance and support for William Carey. He kind of worked inside the associations and stuff, and they established a missionary society, I believe it was. And anyway, people would pledge to give money, and then they wouldn't give it. So he was always trying to get people to give the money they pledged. So stuff like that was going on. But as time goes on, more and more authority and control becomes focused on the leadership of these assemblies. A lot of that was just trying to be like the Methodists or the Episcopalians and stuff like that, who had the really strong centralized church government. Honestly, I think that's a lot of what that was. Now, during this time, Baptist missions began to start. In fact, Baptists were leaders in foreign missions during this time. William Carey leaves England in 1793 to go to India. There does a tremendous work, translates the Bible into, I don't even remember how many languages and dialects, just amazing. Story is, he actually taught himself Greek as he was working. He'd set his Greek textbook up there and nearby where he worked, and he'd just work and read his book. now, this was a very radical idea for them to send somebody halfway across the globe. and very controversial, and he needed a lot of help for that. His chief supporter was Andrew Fuller, and Andrew Fuller does not get the credit he deserves. Andrew Fuller, the story is, and I don't, may not have the quote exactly right, that when Kerry sailed for India, Fuller was there to see him go, and Kerry told him, said, I will go down into the pit if you will hold the rope. And that's what Fuller did. Fuller was able to gain support and help for Kerry as he took off for India. Very influential in his thought. Andrew Fuller, just a little added note here, you can actually buy his three-volume collected works. It's kind of hard to get, a little expensive. I'm not sure how great it is. You can get it, though. But he was also instrumental in breaking some of the very high Calvinistic thought that prevailed at the time. He was a very smart man and was able to challenge a lot of the high. Now he was still a Calvinist, but he was able to challenge some of the almost hyper Calvinism that was prevailing at the time, and to explain why evangelism was necessary, and just accomplished quite a bit. Did a very great work. Now, a couple other guys, Adoniram Judson and Luther Rice, would leave America in 1812 to go as missionaries, originally to India. They left as Congregationalists, but both riding separate ships, knew that they would have to face Kerry when they got there, who was a Baptist, and they wanted to defend their practice of baptizing infants. Well, they began to study the scriptures, and independently of each other, they both came to the same conclusion that what they believed was wrong, and they adopted Baptist views. And he didn't realize that till they actually got to India and were able to talk. I imagine that must have been a very strained conversation as it started out. I can't even imagine how you would start that out, each thinking the other one's going to disown you. But anyway, Judson decides to stay, and the British wouldn't let him stay in India, so he goes to nearby Burma. And there, translate the Bible into the Burmese language and do a great work among the Karen tribe. Luther Rice turned right around, went back to America, and rallied support for Judson and his work. And great debt is owed to him and his work. Now, not without fault, he was pushing for a very strong centralized Baptist government, but he did a great work in stirring up the missionary fervor in America, and his influence and his writings and his sermons were very, very influential at the time. There's also a lot of great church builders during this time who were Baptist. Johann Onken, I hope that's how you say it, O-N-C-K-E-N, Onken, became a Baptist. Excuse me, about 1828. Now, he was a sailor, and I believe he was in New York, and actually, if I remember right, came under the influence of a church and became saved. Well, he came back to Germany, to his homeland, and started preaching, and literally hundreds of churches were started across Germany through his influence and through his ministry. There are also many great Baptist churches in England during the time. One very famous one, Alexander McLaren, but in Manchester, a very influential leader of the Baptists at the time there. But however, almost everybody else in England at the time has to have kind of fade away in the background. The most famous, best known English Baptist during the time is definitely Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Boy, we could talk for hours about Mr. Spurgeon. Built a tremendous work, had the largest church at the time. I mean, by far, the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London, just amazing. Thousands of members. Most churches barely even had 100. He had thousands of members, and Now, he was Calvinist, but he stood by the whole time, the historic Christian faith, and he was definitely strongly a Baptist, very much so. Had a very interesting life. He was saved in a Methodist meeting and became a Baptist. His parents were Congregationalists, I believe. The story is that his mom said, well, I told him, I prayed that you would be saved, but I never prayed for you to be a Baptist. And Charles replied, said, well, Mother, God, as usual, responded above and beyond your prayer. But just tremendous work in his writing and his preaching. His sermons still in print, still widely read, printed all across the globe. I've read stories about people being saved in Australia because they ordered something and it happened to be wrapped in a newspaper that had a Charles Spurgeon sermon on it. Just tremendous work there. Had orphanages and had a widow's home, the pastor's college, one of the earliest, just like a Bible college type atmosphere. Just amazing. You really, honestly, you cannot say enough about Charles Spurgeon. It is an amazing life. Did quite a bit, and taken from this life prematurely. Didn't make it to see the 19, he died in 1890 something. But a tremendous, tremendous man of God and his influence. Now, as I say, he was not without his faults, and some of them are legendary. Most famously, he had a high regard for the Puritans and was a Calvinist. He had yearly meetings where every night they taught about, defended, and glorified each point of Calvinism. But he still was evangelistic and a tremendous mind, tremendous influence. In fact, he was not without controversy. Took a couple of huge stands early in his ministry there in London. He preached a sermon on baptismal regeneration and had all the Anglicans mad at him. Well, that was quite a controversy. And then closed out his ministry with another one called the Downgrade Controversy, where he was battling the slow modernization, so to speak, of the churches and of the colleges and stuff, of liberalism and modernism that was beginning to creep in. And he took a stand and said, and honestly, most of the people thought he was crazy, including Alexander McLaren. And the fact is, as time passed on, Spurgeon was right. So, just an amazing man. You'll do well to get a biography of him and read it, because his ministry is just amazing what he was able to accomplish. Well, moving along, there was also a lot of work in defining and defending Baptist beliefs during this time. I mentioned in a previous lesson, Alexander Carson. He's an Irish pastor, became convinced of Baptist principles, and he wrote many scholarly books defending the faith, most famous of which is Baptism, its mode and subjects. I have a copy of it. It's not the easiest reading in the world, but most people consider that to be the most thorough book on baptism available. So, very influential. That's just one example. There's a lot of Baptist historians also during this time. Now, even as the Baptist message mission was gaining ground, there were a lot of internal controversies that came up. The best known, at least in America, involved a Baptist preacher named Alexander Campbell. Alexander Campbell was a great debater, a very brilliant mind, to be honest and to be fair. And he became convinced that true salvation came through baptism. Now, his influence and his skills as a debater, he did many debates and wrote quite a few books. his influence basically would become the Church of Christ. In fact, for many years they were called Campbellites, following him. Now, he split from the Baptist, and then his movement ends up splitting very, very soon afterwards, and the Church of Christ under Campbell, and then another group that kind of split off of them was the Disciples of Christ, or Christian Church, that was headed by a man named Barton Stone. But those trace their lineage back to Baptists, and what they did is they basically claimed that they held the true historic Baptist doctrines, when that nothing could be further from the truth. And you know, say so there's just a few points of contact, of conflict, but the main one was that they believe you had to be baptized to be saved. So very, very damaging to Baptists. In fact, I mean, for years afterwards, very, very heated debates would take place between them and between Baptists and Church of Christ and stuff. It is very amazing. Other groups split away in fairly peaceful fashion. You know, the Mennonites and the Amish. Of course, they're pacifists. They don't fight anyway, but they pretty much had split off and become their own thing, and hard to even recognize them as having ever been a Baptist at the time. Now, I've touched on it a little bit here, but we're going to talk about some doctrinal controversies. And the example I've touched on before is the downgrade controversy. Spurgeon, becoming alarmed at the growing modernism and flat-out apostasy in Baptist churches and colleges and papers and everything, began to address it and combat it and, call it out in his paper, which was called The Sword and the Trowel. There was a lot of Baptist leaders, and as I mentioned, Alexander McLaren, one of them, who really thought that he was going crazy, he was senile, and that just wasn't a big deal. And it was not near as bad as he had made it out to be. And 20 years later, it was very clear that Spurgeon was right in his assessment. But there were some good men on both sides and of that argument. And at the time, it was really the modernism was just getting to creep into the Baptist circles, and it really would not become that noticeable until years later. So that's the main reason, you know, some good men could fall on both sides of the aisle, because they just honestly didn't see it. Another point of debate that raged really, really for centuries throughout this time is over Calvinism. I've even heard it said that you cannot be a true Baptist unless you are a Calvinist. Others have rebelled so harshly against Calvinist teachings that they took heretical positions just because they were as far opposite as Calvinism could get, such as denying eternal security. So that's the thing. Just because somebody's wrong doesn't mean that you have to take the complete opposite position to be correct. You've got to find the truth, not in conjunction as to what somebody else believes, but you need to find the truth as what's in God's Word. Now, there were some moderate Calvinists, such as Charles Spurgeon, Andrew Fuller, who took heat from both sides in a lot of this. Spurgeon, though, in his preaching, was a very strong Calvinist. In his actions, he was not. And he took a lot of heat for being evangelistic in his sermons and in his approach. And he supported D.L. Moody, for instance, and took a lot of heat from the old school high Calvinists. And they attacked him. And then the more conservative wing that was against Calvinism, they attacked him too, because he held Calvinism, so he just couldn't win for losing. In England, in fact, that this became a major contention point through the years, and you eventually would split. you would have the particular or general Baptists, and basically that was just on their stance on the atonement of Christ is what they were called. The particular Baptists were Calvinistic. They believed that Christ only died for the elect, and then the general Baptist believed that Christ died, made a general atonement, and you know, he died for everybody. So they end up splitting, and there's a little bit more to it. That's a pretty simple explanation of that, but as I say, throughout this time, and even still today, there's a lot of debate on Calvinism. I don't have notes and stuff prepared to really go in depth in that, but the dangerous thing about Calvinism is that there's enough truth in it to where it sounds good. I was going to look up the 5 points of Calvinism. There's 5 main points. There's an acronym, this TULIP, that you'll see quite a bit. But I was going to look it up. I had a coworker who, at a previous job, who was a Calvinist. And I was just going to look it up because we were talking about it. And I was just going to look it up and refresh my memory on it. And when I looked it up, found it on Wikipedia, and looked at it, and I thought, well, you know what? If it wasn't for about one word in every one of those statements, I could take that position. But, you know, it's just it took it to an extreme that I feel the Bible does not take it to. And that's the danger of Calvinism. It sounds good. It looks good. And, oh, it sounds so biblical. But, there's a lot of stuff they take out of context. There's a lot of stuff that is just honestly simply taken to such an extreme that it becomes heresy. And I don't hate Calvinists necessarily. There's been a lot of good men that were Calvinists. A lot of good men are. A lot of very good men, lean that way, even if they may not totally embrace Calvinism. But I've studied it, and I've read quite a bit of Calvinist work. I cannot accept it. I cannot accept it as a series of doctrine. In fact, my theory on it is that Calvinism is not really doctrine. It's actually a method of interpretation. It is a way of looking at the Bible and explaining things that are hard to explain. And the 5 points of Calvinism, when you apply those, it helps explain some of these passages that are a little bit hard to explain. So I think that that's just a very simplified way of explaining some very hard things. So it doesn't make them any easier to explain and explain them the right way and defend against Calvinism. But I think honestly, Calvinism is not doctrine. It's just a system of interpretation. That's my personal opinion. Worth what you're paying for it, which is nothing, I hope. If you're paying for this, you're paying too much. Anyway, all in all, these few centuries we've discussed, very productive and very fruitful years for Baptists. The numbers grew, their influence grew, their message grew, their notoriety grew. There was so many great men and leaders at this time that were very well respected. I mean, we didn't even get into the B.H. Carrolls of the time. I guess I think we'll actually mention him when it comes to in America. Yeah. But some of these guys, I mean, it is just amazing what the Baptists were able to do during this time. Really kind of come into their own, partly through the spread of religious freedom. And partly, I don't know, the society itself making a turn. But the Baptists really come into their own during this time, and a lot of that may be reaping the benefits of previous generations like the Anabaptists, but it's amazing what Baptists are able to accomplish, what the leaders are able to do, and really Baptists take the lead for the first time during this time. I mean, nobody could even compare to what Spurgeon was doing. Amazing. So anyway, very, very great time to study. In fact, to be honest with you, I've said if I could go to any time in history to hear the preachers preach, I would want to go to the mid to late 1800s to Britain and go and hear the McLarens and the Spurgeons and some of those guys. That if I could go back to any point in time, that's where I'd want to go. I'd want to go hear those guys preach. Just an amazing time to study. and some amazing individuals. Read about Carey and Judson and Carson, if you can find anything else about him, especially Spurgeon. You need to read about Spurgeon. McLaren, there's a little bit about him out there, but just some great men, some great things accomplished for God. Well, I'll quit rambling. Next lesson, lesson number 9, we're going to deal with Baptists in America. That's a whole nother ball game. So anyway, I look forward to having you listen in for then. Until then, thanks for listening.